Welcome to Revising Your Peace is what we're going to be going over. The credibility that I bring to the table is, one, I have an English degree. I started out as a business major in college and turned it into an English degree because I was literally on my dorm campus in Minnesota being paid by my buddies to revise their papers before they handed them in for a grade. So I had this understanding of grammar and literature and stuff like that, to the point where I could do it. I started publishing in 1998. When homeschoolers started getting into debate, I started publishing for them. I became an editor of Focus on the Family in 2000. And then I wrote several articles and numerous magazine articles and journals and things like that over the years on homeschooling, on education, on family living. I opened Monument Publishing in 2005. So we actually edit a lot of pieces before they go to press. We're actually going to edit one of Travis's pieces that he submitted to me and is actually published now, but we're going to go through an editing activity at the end here of the presentation. And coaching and competition, my daughter Lydia made it to nationals 3 years in a row in oratory speeches. And we worked together on a lot of the revisions and things like that for those speeches and revising it. And that's really what we're focusing on in this session. Now, you've been learning a lot about how to pick a topic, thesis statements, et cetera, et cetera. A lot of the getting ready. But once you have that draft written, it isn't finished. In fact, it's probably far from finished. A piece really is never finished. There are principles to great editing. Every speaker will be an editor, okay? And that's what we're going to be going through, these 5 points. Where to start and end, staying on target, having the right attitude, keeping the detail, and we're going to go through that example. It's going to be Travis's example. Okay, where to start and end. Who is the most important person in the room when you go to compete? The judge. Very good. It's the judge. It's not your buddies who came in to watch you. It's not your mom who thinks you're the best person in the whole tournament. It's not. It's that judge, and that's who you're going to be thinking about in the tournament. Who do you think about when you sit down and think about what you're going to speak about? Your audience, who is the judge. You start and end thinking about that audience member, the one who's going to decide whether you advance or not in a tournament. That's who you start with. The most important person in your writing is also the judge, not just in the tournament. Begin your topic development studying your audience. We're going to do that right now. Okay, you're going to help me create the next slide. Okay, who is the typical judge? A community judge, school parent, professors, teachers, neighbors. People get kind of desperate. They start asking their relatives, parent judges, church members, pastors, alumni judges, coaches, family friends. Okay, so these are all examples. These are typical judges. Now, this is a broad audience we've got here, isn't it? This is not a narrow group of people. Okay, oftentimes I see platforms that are written for a narrow group of single-minded people. Does that mean your topic isn't going to be challenging? You should water your topic down so that it could be accepted by a broad audience. No, it doesn't, especially if you're like into persuasive speeches and stuff. Some of the most persuasive people the best speeches I've seen were on topics that I disagreed with, but I was challenged, okay? But you always do need to remember this is your audience that you're speaking to. You start your writing based on that, and you continue that understanding all the way through your development of your speech. The next principle is staying on target. Staying on target is very, very important when you are revising your speech, and especially when you're writing. The first draft, you get that out, and then you go back to it a day or two later, and you start reading through it. You got to ask yourself, am I staying on target? I mean by that is avoiding bunny trails, unnecessary digressions. Sometimes you just have to ask yourself, okay, what's this speech about? Well, this line or this paragraph, maybe even this word, I'm going to make an argument that every word is important. You have to keep on focusing on target. Now, what do we call that target statement? Yeah, thesis statement, correct. It is your thesis statement that keeps you on target. Writing a solid thesis statement helps you stay focused. I will make this argument. People disagree with me on this. Well, what about an informational speech? I still make this argument. Every thesis statement needs to have an element of persuasion in it. There's got to be someone out there that's going to disagree with you. And you and your purpose is to persuade them, even if it's an informational speech, a how-to something, okay? Even then, a good speech needs to be persuadable. Or else it's boring, quite frankly. And if it's not a persuasive kind of thesis statement, I'm going to probably fall asleep because I'm just not going to be that interested. Okay? And every paragraph, transition, sentence, and even word must support that thesis. Okay? It must support that thesis. If it doesn't, you either have to change it or throw it out. This is why sometimes it's good to revise your speech a few days after you wrote it. If you go through the revision right after you wrote it, it's easy to skip over those things. It's easy to miss those rabbit trails, okay? Because it's just so fresh in your mind. It's nice to forget about it for a while, then return to it, and then you go, you know, that one paragraph that I thought was really brilliant and what a great idea, or that example that I thought was really cool, really doesn't fit because it's not fitting with my thesis statement. So I'm going to revise that, throw it out, or do something like that. That's why it is, because we return back to our target and really what we're aiming for in our speech. One of my favorite quotes is from Mark Twain. And this is my argument. Even a word could be out of place. This is Mark Twain's quote. If you see an adverb, kill it. You know what an adverb is, right?
L-Y.
L-Y words, right? The words that end with L-Y are oftentimes adverbs. A lot of times our speaking is filled with adverbs, and they're most of the time unnecessary, probably. Mostly, they're unnecessary. They're unnecessary. You see how I just cut that sentence down to what I really wanted it to say? They're unnecessary. But I kept throwing those adverbs in there to fill in the spaces. And in our writing, sometimes those adverbs just clutter things up. So that's why Mark Twain says, if you see an adverb, kill it. Not really, really kill it, because those are adverbs. Get them out of there. Kill it. I want to talk a little bit about attitude. We do have to have a certain attitude when we're going through this process. Editing is a continual process, and you got to get that in your mind. And if that sounds like it's tiring, you got to fix something about your attitude. You've got the wrong attitude. If it sounds exhausting to go back and revise and rewrite and keep working on and tightening up and polishing, if that sounds exhausting, you do have a problem that you have to get over. Because this is what makes great speeches, is that constantly going back and reworking it and making it better. It is actually what makes it enjoyable. I love writing, okay? And I know it's exhausting. Really, when I'm in writing mode and I'm writing books or articles that are really important and I might be even getting paid for it and things like that, I know I'm in for a chore. And sometimes I don't even like starting it because I know it's going to be a lot of work. But I'm not fooling myself either. It is a lot of work. And once I really get into that groove, I enjoy articulating and putting to words what's going on in my mind. You may have heard that third point, a painting is never finished. Ever hear that? Painting is never, what do they mean by that?
Always do something.
Right. An artist's work is never finished. And really, is writing art?
Yes.
It really is. Think of a painting. If I'm a painter and I've got this picture in my mind, okay, and I've got the canvas, the white canvas, what's my job as an artist?
To paint
the picture in my mind onto that canvas. And what's writing? I've got these ideas in my head, and I've got to get them onto paper so that someone else can read it, and then maybe I can perform it so that others could understand it. And that takes a skill. That is art. And it reminds me of a definition of one of my professors back in college. It was my poetry class. And his definition of poetry is extremely limited. It's two words. Condensed thoughts. That's what they are. They're my thoughts condensed into a form and a structure so that I can squeeze as much meaning as possible in as few amount of words as possible. Oftentimes, our papers and our speeches will resemble that. They will be condensed thoughts, because I hope your thoughts are really big and broad and vast and deep. I want to understand that as the judge who's got the ballot and listening to you. That takes some skill. The fourth point is me getting on my soapbox and talking a little bit about my theology or something. I believe we are all created in the image of God. Is that my idea? No, that's what the Bible says. We are all created in the image of God. I believe we have some image of God traits. Image of God traits. How do we resemble God? How do we look like God? I believe creation is one way. We are different from animals in that way. Animals don't build computers. Yeah, they don't. I mean, they don't even build a hut. I mean, in the rain, they find a tree to hide it under. They're not really creating much, okay, at all. So we have an image of God trait, and that's creation. When you write your papers, you are really creating something of your own. And that is something that God wants you to do. He created you to continue this creative momentum. We can't create something from nothing, but when we actually create something on paper, that is resembling what God really wants us and creates us to do. So, hey, am I making this more enjoyable all of a sudden? You know, this is a lot of work. God worked, right? 6 days and rested on the seventh. That was hard work, I bet, creating the universe. Sounds daunting, but He's God. He could do that. But when we create, it's just like walking in the footsteps of God. Okay, and that's what's enjoyable. So therefore, my final point here, embrace the process of writing. Embrace it with full gusto, and that's the attitude we want you to have when you're creating your pieces. Desire the fame and reject the work. You know what? If you make it to nationals and you're in the final round, you become all of a sudden the hot shot in the room. Okay? I oftentimes say that speech and debate is the sport of homeschool for homeschoolers. And the jocks of the homeschool movement are speakers and debaters. You know, really, you go to a homeschool conference and who are the cool kids hanging around? Everyone wants to be like them. They're the speakers and debaters. They're the ones who've been to nationals. Yeah. You know, yeah, I'm a Hall of Famer. I'm cool. But if that's all you desire and you reject the work, who you're fooling? The people who do end up on top are the ones who work hard. Secondly, I'm brilliant. My work will sell. What do you mean, judge? What do you mean my piece was not understandable? I don't allow that talk in my club, actually. Kind of like the judge, I'll nail that. Now, are there bad judges? Of course there are. But we don't dwell on them, okay? And actually, when we do get a bad ballot, we should always ask ourselves, what was it that they didn't like? Even if it's a prejudice, even if they just didn't, you know, I don't like that tie you wore, you know, or something like that, well, okay, change your tie. You know, I mean, there's things you can do to adapt, even to prejudices and unfair ballots, okay? Really, we aren't that brilliant, okay? Until we start recognizing we have to adapt and we have to try to persuade that judge and keep that in mind. The reason I wrote My Work Will Sell is because a common thing, when I worked at Focus on the Family, this was actually kind of funny. A group of editors, there was like 30 or 40 editors that I worked with, so I wasn't the only one there. But we worked with some hot shot authors, you know, these big time authors that would send in their works and stuff. And we would work with them sometimes. They may have written a book on how to be more Christ-like. And then they get bent out of shape when we start editing their work. What do you mean? That was such a perfect work. And no, it wasn't. and we try to edit it. Actually, the good writers oftentimes were the ones who were more open to our editing work. And the bad writers were less open to their editing work. It was kind of an interesting phenomenon. And I give you this. It is because people who are open to editing work and critique will naturally become better writers. And that's why. They ended up throwing our work. We would edit it and they were like thankful that we really dug into their work and made it presentable. So my work will sell also. What are we doing to the judges? I use the word sell. I didn't use the word persuaded or persuasion or something like that. I said sell. What are we doing to the judges? We're kind of like salespeople, aren't we? The judge has how many ballots in a speech round? 7, 8, something like that, right? You're selling them to put your ballot on top. It's almost like a job interview. You know, you're trying to persuade them. You're the man for the job. You're the man for the first place. Circle that first place for me, please. And you have to show that in your presentation. Okay, so it is a salesman job. How do we rate the top books written in America? Best written books? How do we rate it? The New York Times best written list? Best-selling. It's the New York Times best selling list. That's how we rate. So we really are selling the judge. And that's really something that we need to recognize. We've got to sell our work. Also, another bad attitude is quick, get it done. Quick, get it done. Pound it out. Now, there are people, and I've talked with them, that have said they've written the speech the day before the tournament, and on the way to the tournament, in the car, in the back seat, they memorized it, and then they did really well. They didn't work at all, right? I mean, you know some people like that. Quick, get it done, and then they do well in competition. You know what? That they're riding on their talent at that point, their speaking ability, okay? You can't do that in the long run. The champions were constantly always revising their case and working on their speech all year long, all the way up to the point of nationals. I know my daughter did. She took eighth place last year, okay, in the nation. I say everyone in that final round, I bet you every single tournament their speech looked different. They were constantly revising it. The bottom line about attitude, hard work pays off. The next about editing, principles of editing, detail, detail, detail. That's a quote from my vice president at Folks in the Family. He was the vice president of the periodicals department. He would always say, detail, detail, detail. We would beat ourselves up if a typo ended up in print. We would get down on ourselves. Man, I can't believe I let that misspelled word get by. And we would hammer each other too when that would happen. Very critical environment in this editing group. but we all, why? Because we all wanted to get better. We didn't want those things to slide. Now, a lot of what I just talked about is really the telescope ideas, how to start, who to keep in mind. Those are big picture items. But really, drill it all the way down to the very word. You got to have the microscope out too. You've got to be very, very attuned to details throughout your whole speech. If you're developing your speech on a Google document or Word document, you're always modifying it. I suggest Google documents because it has versioning in it. Do you know what I mean by versioning? Or you could go back to a time. Like, let's say you edit it for a while and you go, oh, that just isn't working. I wish I could go back an hour. And then become a student of grammar, punctuation, and usage. And I know you hate to hear that. But you really do need to become a student in the English language. Avoid the it doesn't matter, because it really does. It doesn't matter that we need to have everything punctuated correctly, because ultimately we're going to be speaking these speeches, right? We're not there. You're handing in your script submissions, but they're not proofreading it for typos, so really typos don't matter. Avoid that thinking. You know, if a misspelled word to T-O-O and it should have been T-O, kick yourself for that. You know, be a little critical on yourself. You know, go back and correct that. Okay? Things like that. Go back, make sure that paper is totally, totally clean. I've known people that don't really like the detail part of this. Start to enjoy it. Be a detailed person. Now, before we go into an example, I want to go through five misuses that I jotted down. I mean, there's really, how many common misuses are there in speaking or in editing? There's tons, okay? I'm going to go through five particular ones that are quite popular. The first one is the usage of me or I. Could anybody into grammar and they could kind of whip out exactly what the difference between me and I are? They happen in the object side of the sentence is the me, and the I is in the subject side of the sentence. Which one would it be? Me went to the store or I went to the store? I went to the store. Now, we don't say me went to the store. If you say that, then you're just really... It gets confusing when we start doing pluralities. That's why I threw the second one in there. My friend and me went to the store. Now, that doesn't sound very awkward. Or me and my friend went to the store. You probably talk like that. A good judge that picks up on that will mark that down on the ballot. Bad language. Get your pronouns straight. You know, or something like that. Some of you veterans, have you ever gotten something like that on the ballot? Yeah, you have? Yeah, they pick on the grammar. They go, oh, I didn't hear that sentence right. Rewrite that. And then they ding you. And that's another reason to kick you down on the ranking. Okay, I'm going to give them second instead of first, even though they were a better speaker. But boy, they had some grammar problems. So it will be my friend and I went to the store. You can oftentimes figure out if there's some confusion over which one, me or I. Well, take the plurality out and it becomes more obvious. Like me went to the store. No, it's I went to the store. Therefore, I got to choose I. My friend and I went to the store. The last one. The gift was given to my friend and... Me?
Me.
I?
Me.
Oh, a little disagreement here. All right.
I.
No, actually, it is me. Take out the plurality. Would you say the gift was given to I? Take out the plurality. This is how we solve it. The gift was given to I. Would you say that?
No.
No, you would say to me. Okay? The gift was given to my friend and me. That's how you figure out which pronoun to use. No, this is the correct way to speak, too. So if it sounds awkward, it's just because you're used to saying I. But it is incorrect, and an English teacher like me will ding you on it. Because we do speak like that sometimes, because in the subject, if it was at the beginning of the sentence, of what you use was actually the subject. Okay, my friend and I, you would say it with I, because it's in the subject, the beginning part of the sentence. Next one. Lay or lie is another one. After the tournament, I had to lay down or lie down. Which one?
Lie
down, right. Lie down. When something is receiving it, I had to lie down. I had to lie down. It's lie. When you are actually doing it to something else, then it's lay. Could have, would have, or could have, would have. Let's go through these examples. You could have voted for the right president, or you could have voted. It's could have, right? How about the next example? I would have or would have done better if I would have, would have known. It's actually both would have. Yep. Actually, this is kind of a trick. Would have is actually slang. Okay, it's never acceptable. There's actually lots of usage. Sometimes it spills over into our speaking where we actually say it and we write it the way we would say it quickly. A judge will ding you on this sometimes. If you say would have, because really it's written down as would have, if it's written down as would have, but by saying it quickly we say would have, sometimes a judge, I would write that down. That's going, you know, you're slurring your speech. I heard a couple would ofs instead of would haves. Slow down and pronunciate properly. So this is a common usage problem, but it does roll into our speech quite a bit. Number four, I have been, shortened to I've been, shortened to I've been. You see how we just keep shortening up our speech here. So I've been to debate camps many times. We say it quickly, but it's very incorrect. I've been to debate camp many times, or I have been to debate camps many times. Sometimes, and consider this in your revisions, cut out those contractions. Cut those out. Instead of the I apostrophe V-E, cut it out and say I have and get used to speaking that way. Because a judge will write that down, or I would, if you said I've been. You just cut out a whole word that should be in there. And finally, pronoun errors. Singular is oftentimes confused with the plural. Gender exclusive is no longer acceptable, even in our speech. Okay, so referring to people as he all the time is not acceptable. If it's a person, you should say he or she. So there's a couple of examples. Each speaker brings their own speech. Why is that incorrect? Each speaker is talking about individual speakers, so that's singular. Okay, brings their own speech would be an incorrect usage. Each speaker brings his own speech. Now, his is singular, but why is that incorrect? Oh. The speakers brought their own speeches. You see what I mean? I'm talking about the speakers, all of them, and plural. Here's a way to correct that in our writing, and it should be in our speaking also. Each speaker brings his or her own speech. That's the correct way of saying it. Sometimes when we're writing chapter books or something, there's more creative ways of doing that. That's a good point. We might choose to use he as that plural pronoun, or and she in other areas. And that is, for larger writing, correct usage. But for the point of speaking, when we are actually giving our 10-minute speech, we should do it this way. We should nail it down and either do his or her, or, like was raised there a little ahead of time, the speakers brought their own speeches, turn it to the plurality. Sometimes it takes revising the whole paragraph or something in your speech. Okay, because sometimes we want to talk about the individual speaker or the object or something like that. But sometimes it makes sense to go plural and talk about a group of people. Now I want to talk about tightening up your speaking. We already talked about that. What's in your mind needs to be translated to your audience. That's the purpose of what we're trying to do. And I talked about poetry being condensed thoughts. When is your writing finished? Never. It is never finished. There does come a time, though, where you got to cut it off and start memorizing, all right? Because you got a tournament to go to. Time is the only thing that should keep you from editing your piece. Not laziness. Not, oh, I'm sick of this. Oh, you know, if you're sick of it and you still have a lot of time, just put it aside and go play Ultimate Frisbee for a while or something like that. You know, do something to get your mind off it, because you shouldn't be sick of it. You are creating. You should be enjoying this. Okay, so just throw some hot water in your face or something like that and return to it. But you should never be getting sick of this. Tighten up all your speaking, all of it. You're always tightening it up. Now here's the book that we're going to work on, Keys to Interp. It's a great, great book after I got done with it. But Travis came, and this was a year ago. He came to me and said, I have this idea of a book that's never been written before, like an interpretive speech. And this is what we're going to work on, the very first chapter, Defining Forensic Interpretation. Here it is right here in final draft form. This is what was printed. But we're going to work on that beginning part right there, Defining Forensic Interpretation. But before going into the final draft, here is the draft that was actually turned in. Okay? You can track changes while editing. This is the edited product. This is what I sent back to Travis. Oh, he was crushed. He cried for an hour. But this is how much I edit. Actually, I edit good writing this much. I'm always revising it. And editors know that, you know, really, I hire my own editors to edit my own piece. If I'm going to a serious book like this, I hire some old buddies of mine from Focus to edit my work. Because I know there's a disconnect between my brain and the paper. I know there is. I know what's going on up here. But it's an art to really transform it to paper. I know what's going on. How can I edit what my thoughts are? What do you mean you don't understand what I just said? I just said it, you know, or something like that. It's difficult to do. So writers know they need good editing. So this is how much I did, but we're going to do it together and see what we come up with. Okay, so here we are. Let's read the first sentence. It says, I cheated. I looked up the NCFCA definition of dramatic interpretation. It reads, and then he copies the NCFCA website. Now, let's edit this. What should we change? That's one way of doing it. Yep, I cheated. A semicolon does separate sentences, but so does a period. Okay? Why does he say I cheated? I didn't like that. Why does that rub you the wrong way? That's you can't do that. Right? You can't cheat. And also, is looking up the definition cheating?
No.
No, it's not. I know what he's trying to say here, but it could be received as kind of edgy, you know? I
mean, page.
Right. Who are you considering? When you say that, Christian, who are you considering? The audience. We want to get it to this form, right? Someone who doesn't know him and knows that he's just goofing around, he would say something like that, wouldn't he? Oh, I cheated. You know, but that's not what we want to portray. We're considering our audience when we change this. What else is, you know, we're considering our audience. Who is this being going to be sold to? Homeschoolers, yes. Cheaters, no, not cheaters. Oh, homeschool speakers and debaters, or just speakers at least. Parents of them. But who did he narrow this down to?
NCFCA.
NCFCA. There's lots of different leagues, right? There's lots of different leagues out there. There's STOA, there's CCFSE, there's CCA. Some of these you probably don't even know. I'm into the business, so I kind of know all this. So let's change this. I like the idea of cutting this out. Let's just delete it. How should we change that sentence? I liked what you said, Ben. You said the definition of dramatic interpretation. How about in most leagues? Homeschool leagues. Let's say that, okay?
You really want to be specific when you're citing a source of those.
You can put the source underneath the definition.
Yeah, let's do it. How about a footnote, huh?
Yeah.
How about a footnote? I'm going to stick a footnote in there. This is another thing. Okay, so I say, taken from NCFCA. We focused it. We tightened it up to our audience. We didn't offend anybody. We didn't claim we were cheating.
Do you have to say homeschool league? You could just say most leagues.
Good. Just broadened our audience quite a bit, didn't we? Reads. The definition of dramatic interpretation in most leagues reads. You're not too far off from what I did. This is how I revised it for the final. Speech and debate leagues define dramatic interpretation as follows. The definition of dramatic interpretation in most leagues reads. Yeah, reads is the correct grammar. That's probably why I changed it. Speech and debate leagues define dramatic interpretation as follows. That reads better. Okay, let's keep editing. Okay, so he says, well, that was short and unhelpful. Creativity, oh, then he dices this up. Creatively explores and develops. What does that mean? Suppose we put the work of literature in a pot of stew. That would be pretty creative. Suppose we wrote 3 new chapters at the end. That would develop it. It's a short definition, but it is perhaps a bit too lengthy. I like Paul Campbell's The Speaking of Speakers of Literature, Dickinson, 1967, better. Oral interpretation is the oralization of literature. It's that simple. What do you think? Duh. That's a good example of wordiness and cutting it down. Do we really need that paragraph? Yeah, the whole pot of stew, we're getting off topic. It's a creative way of saying it, but our audience and our thesis isn't what's on track here. It could be argued as a bunny trail. So it's a short definition, but it is perhaps a bit too lengthy. I like, and then he goes on to the liking. Yeah, that could be turned into a footnote. Oral interpretation of literature, it's that simple. Let's see how I changed it. Concise but unhelpful. So I didn't delete the whole paragraph, but I did touch it up. Creativity explores and develops. What does that mean? Suppose we put the work of literature in a pot of stew. That'd be creative. Suppose we added three original chapters at the end. That would develop it. I liked his sarcasm, okay? His sarcasm was a bit Travis-y, okay? And we're starting to get to know Travis and how he talks and speaks. But I emphasized his sarcasm. That's what I did. See how I emphasized it and put quotes around develop it, creatively exploit. I mean, he put the quotes around that one, but this one he didn't. It's a short definition, but it is perhaps a bit too lengthy. I like Paul Campbell's better. See, an editor's work is never finished. It is more concise, isn't it? And that's something about editing, Christian, that you're kind of hitting on, is that none of this is right or wrong. I mean, there are some incorrect usage things that we can ding. Typos should be totally out of your speeches, of course. Okay. But a lot of this is subjective stuff. This is just you becoming a better writer and ultimately a better speaker. And now that's it. Any questions? I should ask any questions on this. Yes.
How long does it usually take?
Forever. How long does it take? Like a paper? Like if you wrote your speech and you're ready to memorize it? I would say you should have at least a few hours into that paper editing before you start memorizing it. Actually, I'd say a few days. I mean, it should be something you write and continually write. And then after you memorize it, you're still working on it.
So.